Exodus, chapter 33, verses 1 to 23, the 32nd talk in a series on Exodus, was presented by David Crabtree on February 25, 2018, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 30, Exodus 33, 1 through 23, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we'll be looking at Exodus chapter 33 today. It has been a little while, so I'm going to spend a little bit of time setting the context. I'm going to be teaching for the next 5 weeks, and my plan is to finish Exodus during those 5 weeks. Okay, setting the context of chapter 33. Remember, going way back to the beginning of Exodus, God decided that he was going to free the people of Israel from their slavery in Exodus, or in Egypt. They'd been enslaved there for over 400 years. God decided he was going to take them out. He raised up a man by the name of Moses to do that job, and Moses performed that service. However, all along the way, there was resistance and rebellion against Moses and his authority. God starts by sending a series of plagues on the Egyptians, the last of which, the biggest plague, the killing of all the firstborn of Egypt. Anyone who did not have the blood of the Passover lamb on the doorposts, in that household, the firstborn died. And as a result of that, those plagues, and particularly the last one, Pharaoh gave permission for the children of Israel to leave. They fled Egypt, and they went to the Red Sea, the Reed Sea. And they were pinned against the Reed Sea, and it looked like they were stuck. And Pharaoh decided, he had second thoughts about having let them go, and he decided this was his opportunity to go and get them back. He sent his army and the chariots after the children of Israel, and it looked very desperate for them. But God opened up the waters of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel were able to go through on dry land. And then when Pharaoh's armies came in to follow after, God brought the water back in and killed them. The Israelites then make their way through the desert from that point, just outside of Egypt, down the Sinai Peninsula. I know that there are arguments for placing much of the Exodus in Saudi Arabia, and in some ways that's kind of attractive, but on the whole, it doesn't look to me like that works. So I'm going with the more traditional route in the Sinai. They went down, it would be the western edge of the Sinai. And at a certain point then, God directed them to turn west and go into the mountains. They went into the mountains and they went to Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai, God made them an offer, and I'll read the essence of that offer. It's in Exodus 19, 5 and 6. God said, "Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. So that was the offer that God made to the sons of Israel, and they accepted the offer. In verse 8, it says, the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So they take him in, they take him up on this offer. A ceremony then is held to mark this covenant, this agreement that's being made. At that ceremony, God spoke the Ten Commandments to the people. So God audibly spoke to the people, directly to the people. And the people, having heard that, were scared to death, and they said to Moses, speak to us yourself, and we will listen, but let not God speak to us, lest we die. And that's chapter 20, verse 19. So from then on, Moses plays the role of an intermediary between the Israelites and God. Direct communication with God is too scary. Moses then met with God on the mountain. He received the rest of the law. And then Moses returned to the people and recounted what God had told him. And once the ceremony then is concluded, they built an altar, they made sacrifice, and once again the people agreed to do what God had told them to do after they have heard the Ten Commandments and all the rest of the law. In chapter 24, verse 7, it says, then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. So then Moses took the blood and he sprinkled it on the people, this is the blood from the sacrifice, and said, behold the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. So the covenant has now officially been made. Moses then goes back up on the mountain at God's request. He goes back up on the mountain, and he's there for 40 days and 40 nights. And during that period of time, he receives instructions with respect to the construction of a portable sanctuary for God that they will carry with them as they make their way through the rest of the desert on the way to the promised land. At the end of those 40 days, God speaks to Moses and said, something horrible has happened. The people have made an idol, have worshipped an idol. They have disobeyed the commandments that I had given them, that I had spoken to them directly. And God tells Moses that he's going to wipe them all out and he's going to start over with Moses. Moses says, don't do that. That would be terrible. He says, remember the patriarchs and remember the promises that you made to them. It's important that you uphold those. And God, he relents. He decides that he will not kill them all. Moses then goes down and sees what's happening. He is horrified. Destroys the golden calf that they had created. It's pounded down to dust. It's mixed with water, and the people are forced to drink it. And then Moses commands the Levites to kill about 3,000 of the children of Israel. Presumably, those were the ringleaders of the rebellion. Then in chapter 32, we saw that Moses, wanting to reconcile God to the people more fully, he decided that he would go and seek reconciliation, seek atonement for them. He goes to God and asks for forgiveness, their forgiveness of their sins. And God relents, and he says that he will send his angel to go before them He agrees to lead them and send his angel to do so. And it's that point then that we pick up the action in chapter 33. 33 verses 1 through 6. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought up from the land of Egypt, to the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, 'To your descendants I will give it.' And I will send an angel before you, and that I will drive out the Canaanite, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, for I will not go up in your midst, because you are an obstinate people, lest I destroy you on the way." When the people heard this sad word, they went into mourning, and none of them put on his ornaments. For the Lord had said to Moses, "Say to the sons of Israel, 'You are an obstinate people. Should I go up in your midst for one moment, I would destroy you.' Now, therefore, put off your ornaments from you, that I may know what I will do with you." So the sons of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments from Mount Horeb onward. So God at this point says, go up, continue your journey, head out towards the promised land. Go with all those people that I brought out of Egypt. So it's God. That is something that God performed for them. And yet there's been rebelliousness. But head out for that land. It's the land that I promised to the patriarch. So it's coming back to the promise that he had made. God is committed to that promise, just as Moses encouraged him to be. And God says, "I will send an angel before you." He had said that before. He had said that back in chapter 24 or 23. He had said that he would send an angel before them. So this is just a repetition of that promise that he had made. Some people make a big deal out of the fact that it says, "I will send an angel here," rather than "my angel." It had said "my angel" in chapter 23 in one sentence, but then later it says "an angel" also. So what some people do with that is they say, when it says "my angel," that means the angel of God. That is God's representation in angel form, that God himself. I'm not inclined that this particular wording here indicates that God won't be there with them, but he does go on later to say, "I will not go up in your midst." That is clear. So he says, "I will send out an angel before you. You have to drive out these people that are in the promised land. It's formidable. There are several of them. There are the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Hittites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites." In any case, there are a bunch of them. So there's a lot of fighting to be done. There are a lot of peoples to be conquered that stand in the way of them taking possession of the land. So it's important that God help them. So the fact that he is sending an angel before them is very significant. But he reminds them that they're going up to a land flowing with milk and honey. When we were in Israel this last time, this came up when we were going through a park just outside of Jerusalem where it shows the way that they did farming back in biblical times. And she had many interesting things to say about the farming practices and how that relates to the Bible. It was very interesting, very, very interesting. In fact, I have since bought about 4 books about agriculture in ancient Israel just to learn some of that stuff. But one of the things she talked about was the land flowing with milk and honey. I've always thought that that expression was talking about a land that was great agriculturally, produced an abundance of food. But if you look at Israel's situation, they can produce quite a bit of food in Israel, and they could in ancient times, but it was a lot of work. The land was difficult to farm and required a lot of terracing, and a lot of labor went into it. And the climate is very marginal. That is to say, the rains have to come in the right amount at the right times in order for the agriculture to be good there. I remember reading, but it was talking about some of the cultures in the South Pacific. And their situation is such that food is so easy to get that they have a lot of leisure time. They get some food out of the ocean, they get some food from the trees, but they do very little work to get that food in abundance. Israel is not the South Pacific. Israel's marginal. Things have to work out just right, and the farmers have to be very diligent and keep up on their tasks in order to get good crops. So I am less inclined to take this phrase, it was a land of milk flowing with milk and honey, as talking about how productive it was. And I would have to say, recognizing that it is not just a place that's just overflowing with food that's easy to get, that's much more like God. There is so much productive in our lives that happens when we struggle. We are healthier when we struggle. Our families are healthier when they struggle. Our children are healthier when they struggle. When life is too easy, it gets confusing and it gets difficult. Our values become distorted. So I think this does not mean that this is a land of great abundance. But as our guide was saying, what it's pointing out is there are two kinds of land in Israel. And this is important. Two kinds of land. There is pasture land where you can raise your livestock. And when livestock are well cared for and there is an abundance of livestock, then something that is in abundant supply is milk. And the other is forest. And forest is a place where you can go to get honey. That's where the bees live. That's where they build their hives. And that's where you can go to get honey. So what she was arguing is this expression means it's a land with good pasture and a land with good forests. And at this point, I'm inclined to think that that's probably right. But then God says, "For I will not go up in your midst because you are an obstinate people, lest I destroy you on the way." We've talked about this before. One of the problems that we're seeing here in Exodus is how does a holy and righteous God be closely associated with a sinful and rebellious people? It's mixing oil and water. It cannot happen. And the problem is when that rebelliousness manifests itself, God has to deal with it. So it's inevitable. If God is closely associated with this people, they're going to be destroyed. That's the problem. And so he's saying, "I will not go up in your midst because they are rebellious and obstinate people." The people were sad to hear this. It is very important to them, and it's very important in this narrative, the difference between God sending an angel before them and God being present with them is not a little difference. That is a huge difference. And for Moses, it's really important. He wants to work hard to bring about a full reconciliation in which God is actually in their midst, not just going before them or sending an angel before them. The people are sad. And because they're sad, they take an action in response to something that apparently God had told them before. God had told them to take off all of their jewelry. Don't wear your jewelry. And having heard that God will not go up in their midst, they take off all of their jewelry. Now, what's the significance of them taking off their jewelry? Well, first of all, it's a sign of mourning, which is appropriate in this case. It's mourning over their own wickedness and the fact that that drives a wedge between them and God. So it's fitting in that sense that they take off all of their jewelry. But there are a couple of other things that could be going on here in addition to that. One is, it could be that God had asked them to take off their jewelry because their jewelry had, in a sense, been a cause of their rebellion. It had been a cause in the sense that they had taken up a collection of their earrings and their jewelry in order to fashion the calf that they then worshipped. Another sense in which the jewelry could have been something more than just a sign of mourning. Some have argued that the jewelry is a sign of the covenant that God had made with the people. Jewelry was a sign of being married. That jewelry was given at marriage and worn by the woman as a sign of being married. It's possible that because this Exodus is in this section is full of imagery that is relating God's relationship to his people to the relationship between a married man and woman, it could be that this is playing off that. And that what had happened is that they had essentially committed adultery by worshiping another god. When they made the golden calf. And as a result, they no longer deserve to wear the symbols of that marriage, of that wedding. You can't continue to celebrate the wedding and despise the wedding at the same time, would be the sense of it. Okay. So they're showing genuine signs of repentance. And that's important as we go on and we will see. Because it had said earlier, when God had spoken to them to tell them to put off their ornaments, he said, "Now therefore put off your ornaments from you, that I may know what I will do with you." So God is in some sense still deliberating what he's going to do. And the fact that they are showing genuine repentance is a significant factor, at least potentially. I think that the next passage is going to show that it is very significant. Verses 7 through 11. Now Moses used to take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, a good distance from the camp. And he called it the tent of meeting. And it came about that everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. And it came about, whenever Moses went out to the tent, that all the people would arise and stand, each at the entrance of his tent, and gaze after Moses until he entered the tent. And it came about, whenever Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent. And the Lord would speak to Moses. When all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would arise and worship, each at the entrance of his tent. Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses returned to the camp, his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. Now this is a little break. This is talking about giving us some background as to what has been happening during the last, and it's not clear how long it's been, but presumably this is a practice that began after the incident with the golden calf. There is no mention of it before, And we've got this tent that's pitched outside the camp, which is indicating a certain amount of distance. And this is a tent of meeting where God comes and is there, is present. The practice that it's describing is Moses used to set up this tent outside of the camp at some distance. He does this on a regular basis. And everyone who sought the Lord, this is a place that they could go and inquire of God. So it's a place where they could go and get their concerns and questions addressed directly by God at this tent. And Moses would go out to this tent, and it presumably Moses then is the intermediary for this communication. Moses would go out to this tent at various times, and whenever he did, when the people saw him going through the camp out to the tent, they would all stand up in front of their own tents and watch him as he went to the tent of meeting and went in. And then when Moses would go into the tent, the pillar of the cloud would descend on the tent. So God is actually coming down and being present in the tent. And then Moses would speak to him. And all the people would see this happening on a regular basis. And when they saw it happening, they not only stood in front of their tents, but they worshiped. This is all significant for two reasons. One reason is it's showing continued respect for God on the part of the people. They seem to be truly repentant at this point in time. And the other thing is God had said, "I will not go in your midst," suggesting that God's not going to be with them. He's not going to be a part of their entourage. But he's willing to come down to the tent of meeting, which is just outside the camp. So God seems to be open to some kind of relationship. It's not continual, and it is at a certain amount of distance, but there is a presence of God that is significant. And then it points out, "Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face." We'll see later that it's probably not face to face literally, but it's talking about a close relationship, like one friend to another. That God spoke to Moses like a friend, and Moses spoke to God like a friend, which is unique. And then we see notice of Joshua. Joshua, remember, had gone up partway up the mountain when Moses had gone up the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, and he camped there. So Joshua is a close associate of Moses, and he is going to take over for Moses later when they go into the Promised Land. Verses 12 through 16. "Then Moses said to the Lord, 'See, thou dost say to me, bring up this people, but thou thyself hast not let me know whom thou wilt send with me. Moreover, thou hast said, I have known you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight. Now, therefore, I pray thee, if I have found favor in thy sight, let me know thy ways, that I may know thee, so that I may find favor in thy sight. Consider, too, that this nation is thy people.' And he said, 'My presence shall go with you, and I will give you rest.' Then he said to him, 'If thy presence does not go with us, do not lead us up from here. For how then can it be known that I have found favor in thy sight, I and thy people? Is it not by thy going with us, so that we, I and thy people, may be distinguished from all the other people who are upon the face of the earth?'" So Moses is apparently seeing an opportunity here. most seeing opportunity for full reconciliation between God and the people of Israel. So Moses starts out by saying, well, you've told us to go, but you said that you would send an angel to go before us. You haven't sent that angel. What am I to make of that? So Moses is sensing that there's God has told them to go, but he's not quite ready. He's hesitating. He's waiting. And Moses is hoping that that is a positive waiting, that God is waiting because he's maybe going to do things a little differently. And I think that the section that we just read, 7 through 10 in particular, are there to underscore that there is reason to think that maybe God would soften. The people are repenting, and God is willing to be present, even if it's just outside the camp rather than in the camp. Moses goes on then to say, "Moreover, thou hast said, I have known you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight." Moses realizes that he has a unique position with respect to God. When God says, I have known you by name, there are not many people in the Old Testament where it is said that God knew someone by name. One of those is Jeremiah, so it's a prophet. So that is an unusual statement to make. It's an honored position. And God has said to Moses, you have found favor in my sight. So Moses is going to build on that status that he has with God and make an appeal on behalf of the people as a whole. He says, since I have this position before you, if it's true that I have found favor in your sight, let me know thy ways that I may know thee so that I may find favor in thy sight. In other words, if you look favorably upon me, then help me to understand better who you are and what you're up to so that I can continue to have your favor. I can continue to do what's right in your eyes. Then he says, consider too that this nation is thy people. In other words, look kindly upon this, your people. So essentially, he's asking for more grace with respect to the people of Israel, based on the fact that they have shown repentance and on the fact that God has hesitated, and Moses, using his status with God, is appealing to him for this grace to be granted. In verse 14, grace is granted, but it's a little tricky here. And God said, my presence shall go, in the Hebrew is, my presence shall go, and I will give you rest. This is tricky in that you here is masculine singular. It's a you, just one person. Now, a number of commentaries say that it is not uncommon for God to speak to the people of Israel as an individual and therefore use you in the singular. I haven't looked at all of such occurrences, but the ones that I have looked at are in a poetic context. So I am inclined to not think that this is talking about Israel as a whole, but it's actually talking about Moses. God is saying, my presence shall go, and I will give you, Moses, rest. That is to say, I will help you. I will give you the kind of support and help that you need. Moses follows up. That's not satisfactory to Moses. That's not what he's looking for. He's looking for full reconciliation. So he says, if thy presence does not go, do not lead us up from here. In other words, if you're not going with us, if you are not going to be present with us, then don't lead us out of here. Let's not go at all. And then his appeal is, for how then can it be known that I have found favor in thy sight, I and thy people? In other words, if you don't go with us, how will it be made known to both us and people elsewhere that we have the special status that you have granted to us, that we are indeed your chosen people? And he says, is it not by thy going with us so that we, I and thy people, may be distinguished from all the other people who are upon the face of the earth? So Moses is pushing the point. It's got to be you going with all of us, your presence being with us as we proceed. Verse 17. And the Lord said to Moses, I will also do this thing of which you have spoken. For you have found favor in my sight, and I have known you by name. Then Moses said, so God is agreeing to do what Moses had said. God is going to go with them. His presence is going to accompany them. He has granted that request. And that indicates a full reconciliation then that's taken place between God and the people of Israel. So Moses responds. Verse 18, then Moses said, I pray thee, show me thy glory. And he said, I myself will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious and will show compassion on whom I will show compassion. But he said, you cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live. Then the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me, and you shall stand there on the rock. And it will come about while my glory is passing by that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take my hand away, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. Moses' response to God being willing to make full reconciliation is he wants to see God's glory. It makes him intrigued and curious and driven to see God and who God is. So Moses says, let me see your glory. And God says, and God agrees to it. He says, I will make all my goodness pass before you. And he says, he goes on to say, I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious and will show compassion on whom I will show compassion. Fascinating that he picks out that one thing to talk about. It's his graciousness and his compassion that he wants to talk about. Those are his distinctive features. He says, you won't be able to see my face. You can't see my face. It's not clear to me exactly what that means. Umberto Casuto says that it is just not possible for a mortal to see the infinite God, which is probably true. But it's also, I think, that it can't be allowed, that there would be something improper about that, inappropriate about that, even if it were possible. God is so totally other that he is so righteous and so holy that that can't be allowed. So God comes up with this arrangement whereby Moses can indeed see him, that is, in a sense, and yet not see his face. So Moses is instructed to stand on this rock, and then God is going to hide him in a cave in the rock, and God will cover him with his hand as he passes by, and then remove his hand and allow Moses to see his back. But that's all that he will see of him. Okay. There are three things that I like to talk about in concluding things to pull out. One is the nature of Moses' mediation. I'd read through Exodus several times before starting this teaching through the book. Never had I really appreciated what a phenomenal human being Moses was. And it really shows up in this section, it seems to me. Moses, in the wake of this thing that the people of Israel have done, where they have sinned gravely against God, God had just given them verbally the Ten Commandments, and yet 40 days later, they're violating several of those. So, but when God says, I'm going to destroy them, Moses says, and God's saying, I'm going to destroy them, and I'm going to start over with you. What a phenomenal offer. And yet Moses says, no, that's not good. Because you have to remember the patriarchs. Moses is really intent on saving the people and making sure that God fulfills his promises to them. And that is in spite of the fact that the people have been rebellious against Moses' leadership all the way. But Moses has come to truly identify with his people despite their blemishes and insists that God does not destroy them. But then he goes back. Just keeping them from being destroyed is not enough. He goes back and he seeks atonement for them. He wants God to forgive their sins. And Moses so identifies with his people at this point that he says, if you're going to kill them, you got to kill me too, because I'm one of them. Moses is so identified with his people that he thinks that he should suffer their fate if that's what God chooses to do. And it's on that basis then that he appeals for their sins to be forgiven. That's amazing. And then what we see in this chapter is Moses wants to make sure that God is going to be not just leading them with an angel in front of them, but God is actually with them, present with them. And he won't rest until he convinces God to do that. And that's exactly what he does. So there are three things with respect to Moses that come out of these. One is his willingness to lay down his life for his people is pretty amazing. The second thing is Moses never ever argues in any of these three times that he's talking with God that there is any deservedness on the part of the people of Israel. He never says you shouldn't kill them because of who they are. Because they're good people. Even because they've repented. He never uses that argument. He does appeal to his own standing with God as a reason that God should spare the Israelites. And he uses the fact that God has made promises to them that need to be kept. And the third thing we see is the extent of Moses' determination to get full reconciliation for all the people of Israel. It's truly amazing. He's quite a character. I am awestruck. The other thing I want to talk about is God's self-revelation, the way that he reveals himself to Moses. This bears a resemblance to another time that God reveals himself to someone. And I want to read through part of that very quickly. It's Elijah. It's in 1 Kings 19. And I'll tell you what's leading up to that. And most of you probably remember it, but there had been the Elijah was a prophet to the northern kingdom. So this is much later. Elijah was a prophet to the northern kingdom at a time when the northern kingdom was very wicked. The king was very wicked, and the queen was wickeder. And Elijah called for there was a drought. Elijah said, "It's because you're wicked." And he called for a contest to be held between the prophets of Baal and Yahweh. And it's on Mount Carmel then that this contest happens. And I won't go through all the details, but the deck is stacked against Yahweh. And yet the prophets of Baal are unable to bring fire down from heaven to consume the bull on the altar. And yet, when Elijah prays, the fire does come down. It consumes all of the bull on the offering, on the altar. So Elijah has won, and all of the prophets of Baal are put to death. All, I think it's 200 of them, were put to death. So then Elijah prays that the rain will come back. And he prays, and the skies are clear. He prays, the skies are clear. He keeps sending his servant back to look out towards the ocean where any rain would come from. And seven times the servant goes, and still no clouds. But the seventh time, there's a little cloud, a little puff. And Elijah says, I can hear the sound of the rain coming down. And so Elijah takes off running to the capital city. And he tells Ahab, the king, you better go. It's going to rain, and you and your chariot are not going to be able to make it through the mud. But Elijah gets there first, and Jezebel, who is really a wicked queen, she learns of what has happened. And I think it has to be the case that Elijah is thinking, after that great victory, now everybody's going to repent. It is so clear that God is truly God, and that all of those gods that our people are worshiping are false gods. It is so clear that now they'll all repent. And Jezebel, essentially, when she hears what happened, threatens Elijah's life. So Elijah takes off. And I think he's more disappointed than scared. That this has just been devastating. He thought this was going to turn things around, and it didn't. So he takes off and wants to die. And he is supernaturally cared for. An angel comes and provides him with food and says, and he eats it, and then he takes off. In chapter 19, verse 8, it says, "So he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God." Well, Horeb is Sinai. That's another name for the same mountain. So Elijah has run to Sinai, having eaten enough to last him 40 days and 40 nights. Then I'll read in verse 9. "Then he came there to a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?' And he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, torn down thine altars, and killed thy prophets with the sword. And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. So he said, go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by. And a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of gentle blowing. And it came about when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? Then he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, torn down thine altars, and killed thy prophets with the sword. And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And then just the first part of verse 15, and the Lord said to him, go. That is one of my favorite passages. Elijah is approximately at the same place where Moses was. It may have been the same cave, but it's on Mount Sinai. Elijah goes into a cave, and God, there's a revelation of God there. But it's a little different than the one that Moses sees. In this case, there is first the strong wind and the breaking of rocks, but God was not in that. Then there was an earthquake, but God was not in that. And then a fire, but God was not in that. And then we have the still small voice, the sound of a gentle blowing. So what God seems to be communicating there is what Elijah wants is he wants these acts of power and acts of judgment that's going to turn the country around, that's going to cause them all to repent and fall down before God. And if they don't, they die. And what God is saying with this demonstration is, but that's not me. That's not what I do. It's not the way I generally operate. It's not that God is opposed to that. There are the time and place for that, and he does do that. But that's not his general mode of operation. His general mode of operation is just a quiet voice. It's just a gentle prodding, trying to urge people to do that which is right. And he's very patient, long-suffering in the midst of all that. But that's his general mode of operation. And I think that fits well with what he's doing with Moses, in that when he reveals himself to Moses, Moses sees only his back. Why only his back? And I think the answer is Moses is not going to see him straight on. Moses is not going to see him face to face. He's just going to see his tracks. He's only going to see his backside. That God is going to be seen in the things that he does. He's not going to be seen directly. Okay, the other thing I'd like to point out, third thing, I am really struck by the fact that in this passage, twice, Moses asks to know God's ways. And the second time that he asks, he wants to see God. He wants to see God's glory. And it's just after God has decided to become fully reconciled with his people. What's striking to me is that it is Moses is responding to God's graciousness. It's God's graciousness that is so impressive that Moses wants to know this God. Who is this God who would do this kind of thing? And I think that's very interesting. That is certainly my experience. That it's understanding the depth of my sinfulness, my rebelliousness, and the extent to which God goes to forgive that and to bring us along anyway, to have a relationship with us anyway. That is astounding. And it makes it, it's not just that God is powerful, but that he is so kind, he is so gracious, he is so loving. How can that be? And I find that very motivating to figure out who he is and what he's up to. Okay, a little bit of time for questions or comments.
Thank you, David. Mm-hmm. So back before the golden calf incident, Moses goes up on the mountain, and it says he and the elders of Israel, the 70, see the God of Israel, and the glory of the Lord is there, and you know, there's sapphire pavement in the sky, and it's quite a scene.
Right.
So after this incident with the golden calf, here's Moses, Yahweh's saying, I'm not going to go up with you. Moses entreats him. So when, and you know, Yahweh concedes, or however you want to say it. Mm-hmm. So my question is Moses asking for something new that he has not yet seen before when he says, show me your glory? Or is he in some way, shape, or form saying, show me that your covenant faithfulness is still intact just as you show, you know, just as I saw you before, show it to me again. Is that, or is this something new? Is this something
right.
different?
Right.
And then I have a follow-up. But
well, that's a great question. And one of the things, I'll ask you to let me save it till next week because I don't know the answer yet. One of the things that I want to look at is they're essentially going to reestablish this covenant. There's going to be a new, they're going to go through essentially the same steps they did to establish the first covenant. But there are some differences. And the question that I'm going to be looking at is, are those differences significant? Or is that just an abbreviated form of the first ceremony? So it's related to what you're saying. And let me try to answer that next week after I look at it some more.
Okay, and you may want to say the same.
Probably.
This, but you sort of touched on it, but when he says, show me your glory, is he asking for something? What is the essence of what he's asking? Would you say?
I think what he's asking is, I want to see what is distinctive about you. What is it that makes you the God that you are? What are the distinctive? It's kind of like asking him. If you were going to describe yourself, what would you say? What would, of all the things that you could say about yourself, what would you pick out and say, this is me?
Okay, and I know next week will be key to that, but
yep.
Okay. All right, thanks, David.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You may want to save my question for next
Probably.
Week, too.
But
I think it's interesting that they have to go through the steps of making a covenant again.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, what happened with the covenant that they made at first? Is it, well, that one is broken, so we need a new one because you guys didn't hold up your end of the deal?
Right.
And part of that question, a side question to that also is, would God have been justified in just abandoning them? I'm going to go start over with the Chinese, mm-hmm. or something like mm-hmm. that, because mm-hmm. you guys have ruined this.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that Moses appeals to the promises God made to the people. And I was kind of looking to see if there were where that was, and I'd be curious to hear where you saw him appealing to the promises made to the people, because I didn't really see anything about that, and so that kind of started the whole
mm-hmm.
question for me of what is the nature of the covenant that he's made with them here. Okay, that was a lot.
Well, I think that he would have been justified in ending the relationship. I think he would have been. And I think that the relationship is likened to a marriage relationship. And it is as if they committed adultery. They left the relationship. And I think it's seen in that light. And so it is God's graciousness that he brings, that he reconciles with them. Now, with respect to the promises, let me see if I can find it quickly. In chapter 32, verse 13, this is the first time, this is when God says, I'm going to wipe them out. And Moses says, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants, to whom thou didst swear thyself by thyself, and did say to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and all this land of which I have spoken I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So those are the patriarchs and the promises.
So that's part of the question that I had, because Moses isn't appealing to any promise that God has made with the people who are gathered here at Sinai. He's appealing to the promises that he made to
right.
Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who right. were faithful
right.
and kept their ends of those covenants. So is what Moses is saying, oh, we're so close, like we're so close to you realizing these promises that you've made all this time ago. You've brought these people out of Egypt. We're almost to the promised land. Like, you can't give up now, God. Is that the nature of what he's saying, or is it something different?
Well, I would have to think about that, but I'm inclined to think that what he's saying is, you made these promises. It is not like you to not carry that through, regardless of what has happened. It is, you are a keeper of promises, I think is the appeal.
And how would... Sorry, I can stop asking questions. How would him starting with Moses not be keeping those promises?
It would be.
Mm-hmm.
I think. I don't know why it wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's why that's the arrangement that he offers. I'll wipe them all out, but you are also a descendant of those patriarchs. I'll build from you.
So is it just Moses saying, I'm not going to go along with that. You have to kill me too. And
yeah,
then you won't be keeping your promises.
I think what he's saying is, one of the things that I think God has been doing with Moses throughout Exodus is he wants Moses to love this people like God himself loves them. And he's brought him to this place where Moses does love them as much as God loves him. And God is kind of testing him, saying, I'm going to wipe them all out. And Moses says, don't do that. They're your people.
Thanks.
I think you can answer my question this week.
I doubt it.
In 33:11, I'm just curious about Joshua there,
mm-hmm.
because we don't see Joshua going up with Moses, and yet it appears when it says that after Moses then is at the tent of meeting and meets with God, then Moses goes back to the camp. But Joshua doesn't depart from the tent. And I assume that means the tent of meeting.
Yeah.
So we don't see him go up with Moses. Does he stay there? And does that say anything about his relationship with God? Or that what's happening there?
Yeah. Yeah, I should be able to answer it this week, but I don't know if I can. Joshua is a very curious character in this, because Joshua goes up with Moses up to the mountain when Moses is there for 40 days and 40 nights, and he comes back with Moses. So Joshua was not a participant in the worshiping of the golden calf. But we don't really have, it doesn't really say anything else except Joshua's the one who says, it sounds like the sound of war down there. And Moses says, no, it's not the sound of war. And then we have this where Joshua apparently is kind of the guard and is stationed at, he stays there all the time apparently. Moses leaves and comes back, but Joshua just stays parked right there. So we're getting some intriguing details, but it's hard to put together what is the nature of Joshua's position. But he's clearly an understudy for Moses and shares some of the traits and some of the history that Moses has.
Yeah, and apparently isn't afraid of the presence of God the way the people were.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm partly taking my cues from Romans chapter 10 mm-hmm. and the way Paul uses it. He quotes, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion here. But it seems to be the way Paul is reading this is God has come in response to Moses and said, okay, I'm not going to give up on the people of Israel being my people. We're going to follow through on that. I'm going to make the people of Israel my people. However, there is a proviso. When it comes to individuals within Israel, I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion, and I will have mercy upon whom I will have mercy. There is no guarantee to an individual Israelite that they are going to receive the mercy and compassion of God. God retains his sovereignty over how he's going to deal with individuals. And that's what fits the context of Romans 10, because where he says, starts off, not all Israel is Israel. What he's saying, just because you're a member of the people doesn't mean that as an individual you're necessarily going to benefit from all the grace and mercy of God. That's up to God and his sovereignty to decide that. So it seems to me that it's part of him teaching Moses his ways. If you are pleased with me, teach me your ways so I may know you and continue to find favor with you. It seems to me that part of what he's doing there is teaching him his ways. Yes, I will relent of my feint to reject Israel. I will relent of that. But if you want to know what I'm up to and what my purposes are, you need to realize that when it comes to individual salvation, I am a sovereign God who does as he wills. Mm-hmm.
Good. Good. That's good. And that fits with what he had said at the end of 32, verse 33. And the Lord said to Moses, this is when God grants atonement to the people of Israel. He says, and the Lord said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. But go now, lead the people where I told you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. One more and then we'll...
When you were speaking earlier about Moses not being able to see God's face,
mm-hmm.
I was a bit... It was curious because isn't there sections in Revelation and the New Testament where it talks about after the end times that we will behold God and throw our crowns down and worship him. I guess I have this vision of that we will see God. Maybe not. I don't know how to phrase that, but mm-hmm. what is your response to that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the passages well enough to know whether we see him face to face in the hereafter. This is talking, I think, about in this life that we do not see him face to face. One of the curious things, just looking at several of the visions that prophets had of God, I have yet to see one where the prophet sees God's face. See his feet, see his hair, see various things, but I have not seen any hint of them seeing his face, even in a vision, which I think is interesting. Okay, thanks.